it's time to talk about the music of another French composer, Gabriel Fauré, with Roy Howitt and Emily Kilpatrick, who have been editing his songs. We're going to hear one of those songs now, sung by Rosalind Martin, and it's S'il est un charmant gazon, words by Victor Hugo. Well, that was a song by Gabriel Fauré, and it was performed by Rosalind Martin, and Roy Howitt was at the piano, and it was from Volume 1 of Fauré's Complete Songs, a new critical edition by Roy Howitt and Emily Kilpatrick. Thank you, Rosalind. Thank you, Roy, and welcome to the show, Emily.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's, well, when you have a body of work like this, some songs, some of them are quite well-known songs, some of them less well-known, how do you set about a critical edition? Do you, in the first place, go searching for manuscripts?
Yes, we have a look at all the available source material over which the composer had any kind of control at all. And also we try and find out anything that the composer said to performers, put it all together, see how it all compares. Also, we have a look at it all and see what problems we're aware of in existing editions, existing sources, existing traditions, things that have to be straightened out. It feels a bit like being a bit like osteopathy at times, just getting rid of the knots.
Yes, I can see that. Well, I mean, in the case of the song that we've just heard, I mean, for a start, it's got, I thought this song was called Rêve d'amour.
It was indeed published under that title, much to Fauré's disgust. There's a wonderful letter where he wrote to a friend saying, Choudens, my publisher, has decided to call this song Rêve d'amour, not something I would have chosen.
So it's not a dream of love, then. It's the other thing that is very surprising to me, listening to your performance there, it was so fast.
Well, we were playing it from an early manuscript. This is the story of many of Fauré's early songs. He didn't have a publisher at the time, and many of these early songs weren't published until anything up to 12, 13, 14 years after he had written them. In this case, he wrote out a beautiful manuscript, gave it probably to his singer, had no longer had any control of it, kept a rough draft, and years later when it came up for publication, he then had to try and tidy it up again, mark it up, but it was much less fresh in his mind. And I think he just marked it up for publication a little less clearly in terms of indicating how lively the song is in his original conception. So what we've done with this song, exceptionally, is to print it in two versions, one from the early manuscript, because it's such a lovely clear version, and it has such a lovely snappy ending, which is quite different from the final one. The song has sort of got more and more languid with the years and soppier, to the point that it's generally regarded as one of his less good or one of his worst songs.
Well, maybe that false title was partly responsible.
Oh, it's hugely responsible. Funnily enough, the title has come from the last verse of the poem, S'il est un rêve d'amour, but it's just a passing glance at the words, and then it's been larded all over the poem, which is not about that. It's quite cheeky. It's boy fancies girl, the usual.
Because it's a he's a teenager when he wrote this song.
Absolutely.
I mean, you think of Gabriel Fauré and the big white handlebar moustache and so on, but the idea of this 17-year-old writing a song I can't imagine a 17-year-old Fauré.
Well, a cheeky teenager with Saint-Saëns as his piano teacher, really enjoying being experimental and enjoying being cheeky. And, you know, in his latter years, his memoirs mostly consisted of all the tricks that they used to get up to at school. And you can kind of hear that in this version of the song.
His friend said there was always something of the naughty schoolboy about him, even something of the street urchin.
Well, let's hear the version or the end of the song as perhaps other people might know it, and then maybe you could do your version again. Can you contrast what we've just heard with the earlier version in your edition?
Absolutely. From the same place.
Yeah. Yes, I think he was right the first time. I think the teenager wins, don't you?
Absolutely. And the lovely thing is with that first ending is you realise that the poem itself isn't very serious either.
No, exactly.
Which is a nice view of Victor Hugo, too.
Exactly. And it's also, it sort of points out the fact that the rêve d'amour was, as you say, a sort of throwaway line. Mm. One of the things I think that's very striking about Fauré's early songs is that he's there already. I mean, his style is quite clear. It's quite recognisably Fauré in that song, and in Lydia, which is one of his most famous songs, which was written only a couple of years after this one, wasn't it?
That's right. Even his very first song, Le Papillon et la Fleur, the butterfly and the flower, which he wrote when he was 16, so very much still a student. And the very first vocal bar is playing with alternations of 6/8 metre and 3/4 metre in this way that's typical of what he does all his life, playing with different contrasted sense of rhythm and the voice cutting against the piano. And it's there from the first bars of his first song.
Now, how did you? I must ask, how did you come to be editing Fauré's songs? Who thought that this was something which really must be done?
It's part of a series. I've been editing some of Fauré's instrumental music, his piano music, and some of his chamber music for Peters for the last almost 20 years now. And as this went along, a good few years ago, Peters' edition said to me, "How about the songs?" And I said, "Oh, it's a very interesting idea. It would be a huge amount of work." We'd set off one or two paths of research to see what it would involve. And then they came back to me more recently, about 5-6 years ago, and said, "We really would like to do these songs." And I thought, it's far too much for one person to do. But of course, Emily was there. And it's right in the middle of Emily's research fields of research and expertise, so between us.
Well, the other lovely thing is that we were very lucky in that we had the funding of the Arts and Humanities Research Council, who funded us for 3 years, based at the Royal Academy of Music, to do something quite special with the project, which was not just to sit there with the piles of manuscripts and the old editions, but to work very closely with students at the Academy and then at other institutions as well. So to run lots of workshops and seminars, masterclasses, concerts, all sorts of performances, so exploring with university students and professional performers and teachers where they found that there are problems in the songs, the things they found difficult about performing the repertoire, the things that they would like to see in a new edition. So it was just a really unique opportunity to try to do something quite different with an edition.
It's interesting, isn't it, that you would have to guess that in many ways a lot of the bad habits that have crept into the performance of Fauré's songs are the fault of singers. But you've been using singers to sort of get rid of some of those bad habits.
Well, absolutely. The nice thing is that there's the really fine singers who worked with Fauré during his lifetime left some very clear statements about what he wanted. There's a wonderful story that the violinist, actually, Hélène Jourdan-Morange, told about watching Fauré accompany a singer, a not-so-good singer, at an evening soiree, and she said this singer was driving Fauré up the wall. She was languishing over every cadence, dying on all the top notes. And Fauré, she described Fauré's playing as the motorway of the future, you know, a route without deviations. He dragged this poor singer along, and as she came to the end of the performance, Fauré had vanished from the stage and was off down the street by the time she'd finished her bow.
But isn't it interesting how, whenever you are on the show, Roy and Emily, we're inevitably talking about French music. We have talked together about Ravel and about Debussy, and it so often comes down to the same thing, doesn't it? Which is stop pulling my music around.
Yes, the rhythm is intensely expressive in this music, as well as the beautiful sound. But French music, it's like French food. It tastes beautiful the minute you hit it. And so, of course, there's always that temptation to stop and have a picnic on every nice chord or every nice note and have a second helping of it. And like a good French meal, you don't have second helpings of everything. You just have the right amount of everything, and it all adds up beautifully.
And in the songs, I think, and this again goes for not just Fauré, but Debussy and Ravel and all of them, these are the composers who are so intensely aware of text and who talked a lot about the importance of speaking the poem, of understanding every nuance of the poem. And so there's such a strong declamatory sense in the text that if you start pulling the rhythm around, you lose the sense of the spoken poem, which was something that Fauré was very insistent that singers retain.
I think that's crucial in that for most of these songs, it's the natural speed at which one would read the poem that is the tempo for the song.
Yes. Well, now, having mentioned poems, let's go to the vocalise, where there are none. And what are these? I didn't know about these vocalise. What are they?
Well, actually, we can lead from poetry into the vocalises, because when Fauré was appointed director of the Conservatoire in 1906, the very first thing he did was to reform the singing school, and the first thing he did in those reforms was to ensure that singers actually learned art song, which hadn't been part of the curriculum before. They're all singing sort of second-rate grand opera and nothing much else. So Fauré's two major things were the singers were going to sing art song and they were going to study technique, and central to the study of technique were vocalises. And so the conservatoire professors all wrote vocalises for the sight singing examinations. But Fauré, when he took these over when he became director, and his were quite unique in that they were not these sort of opera, second-rate opera, flourishy little numbers, but they were very bare, very focused, very song-like small pieces. And so we discovered these in the French National Archives several years ago. It's one of those wonderful moments that you don't get very often as a researcher, when a big pile of documents lands on your desk and you look through it and you realise you're picking out manuscript after manuscript by a wonderful composer, and all this material that it's never been published
and
before.
Really beautiful music,
and very beautiful music,
not just examination tests.
So you think that he intended them to be performed?
He wrote them specifically to be performed as sight reading,
yes,
tests at what were then public examinations. So it was performed, but of course they weren't published at the time because they were repeatedly reused, and so they had to be kept under wraps.
Of course, yes. Mm. Let's talk then about the French language and how that affects the nature of the melody, because it seems to me that there is something which is absolutely distinctive about the songs of Fauré and Debussy and Ravel and the other French composers, which is very different in terms of quality from Schubert and Schumann, and that language has something to do with that.
It absolutely does. I mean, one fascinating thing is that in reviews of concerts and whatever around the turn of the century, when reviewers wrote of a singer's performance, sometimes they'd use the verb chanter, which is to sing. She sung these songs very well. But often they would also use the verb dire, which is to speak or to say. So they would say, Mademoiselle whoever spoke or told these songs exceptionally beautifully. Which is a very interesting way that she used the verb dire to refer to performance.
And the composers in their correspondence nearly always use that verb.
Yes.
And they talked about the whole idea that in French song, because the French language has such unusual inflections and not very fixed inflections, somehow it's a different challenge setting it within musical meter in such a way that the music sort of talks its way through the song rather than being cradled in the music in the way that German song would be, for example.
So there's so much flexibility of rhythm and accentuation, which is a wonderful thing about performing this repertoire. Despite where the stresses of the music fall, there's often a lot of flexibility where the vocal stresses fall, what words you accentuate, and that doesn't have to be the same across phrase to phrase or on repetitions of the word.
When you came to the famous songs like Lydia or Après un rêve or Nell, which you're going to do for us, did you feel a sort of extra responsibility to, you know, I mean, the idea of saying, well, okay, I think we should do this at double tempo or something?
One of the main rules, I think, is don't fix what's not broke. So if we wanted to see what was working well, make sure that we didn't inflict any accidental damage, as it were. But at any stage where we saw something that brought something into sharper focus in the sources or that solved problems, this is what we were watching out for the whole time.
And in fact, Nell does offer an example of that, because it's long been printed with the metronome mark of 69, which singers have known ever since it first came out, was far too slow. And I think Pierre Bernac, for example, noted that in his volume on French songs, that this is clearly an error. And there's no source that gives any other metronome mark, but Roy, by comparison with other of Fauré's music, he does tend to get metronome marks wrong sometimes.
And sometimes it's simply an engraver's error. I've seen a few cases in his instrumental music of his written 69 being misprinted as 96 or the other way around.
Oh, right, that's a big difference.
And we're sure that it was 66 that was printed this song, and we're sure that it's an error for something like 96.
Yes.
The printer just misread
something.
I
don't think I've ever heard anybody sing it at 66.
No.
Occasionally.
And it's another of these songs that has this sense of breathlessness.
Yes.
Sometimes people are troubled by it, and it's nice to have the addition to reassure them and say, don't worry, we are sure that it is meant to move along.
It's a beautiful song, and Roy, I know that you're particularly fond of the bass line, and maybe you could just demonstrate this beautiful bass line for us before we actually hear it in the context of the song.
All it is really is a descending scale, but wanders along, but it's a beautiful counterpoint to the voice, and as you perform it, you'll hear how it sort of comes in against the voice, it takes over the voice's phrases. Fauré always thinks you always hear the bass lines in his music.
And
he's a contrapuntalist.
Well, let's hear it. It's a setting of Le Comte de Lille, and it's going to be sung for us by Rosalind Martin, and I've no idea who's going to be sitting at the piano now. Emily is playing the piano. Emily Kilpatrick is playing the piano, and this is Gabriel Fauré's song Nell. Oh, That's Nell by Gabrielle Fauré, sung by Rosalind Martin with Emily Kilpatrick at the piano, and we recorded that conversation a few weeks ago, actually. The first volume of this new critical edition of Fauré's songs, edited by Emily Kilpatrick and Roy Howard, is now available from Peter's Edition. And if you wanted to see Fauré's moustache, which we did briefly discuss in that segment, go to our website. There's a little clip from YouTube of a clip of Fauré smoking a cigarette and hiding behind this huge handlebar moustache as an old man.